You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job has begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hello, this is The Review, a podcast from The Atlantic's culture team about movies, television, and all the things we make to entertain ourselves. I'm Sophie Gilbert, a staff writer at The Atlantic, and I'm joined today by two other staff writers on our culture team, David Sims.
Hello. Sorry.
Realize I should do a Batman voice.
David Sims, doing his best Batman, and Spencer.
Should I do the Riddler one?
Hi, Spencer.
Hello.
Is that how the Riddler talks?
I mean, he would do anything other than speak in a normal voice, it seemed like.
So, right. He's moving octaves up and down, I guess.
Yeah, he's like,
right?
Mariah Carey.
At the top of the bottom, right.
How are you both doing? How are you surviving the drops epidemic in Gotham?
Yeah, we've got to do something about it. But, you know, the answer is not turning to costume vigilantes. It's expanding the social safety net, personally. That's how I feel. Yeah.
Yeah, I did like that as the message from the movie we are here to talk about today, which is obviously The Batman. Articles are very important. The newest film iteration of The Caped Crusader. It is directed by Matt Reeves and stars Robert Pattinson as Batman / Bruce Wayne. The movie is already the highest grossing film of 2022. But this is surprisingly the first standalone Batman movie in 10 years. I think The Dark Knight Rises came out all the way back in 2012, which makes me feel really old. There's been no shortage of comic book movies in that time, it is true, but it's still interesting to reconsider Batman now and think about the genre without all the weight of universe building and all the connected franchises and all the important pieces that you may or may not know. So with this in mind, I wanted to talk today. David, maybe you can have some thoughts on this subject to kick us off, but what does the Batman say about the state of superhero movies right now? Like, what are we supposed to read from the success of this film?
I do think it's interesting, as you say, that it's not like we've been in a Batman-free zone since the Christopher Nolan saga came to a close 10 years ago. There's been Ben Affleck Batman kicking around in that whole universe.
The Batfleck.
Yeah, Batfleck himself. There, you know, there was a Lego Batman who popped up, right? You know, we've had plenty of Batman conversations, but there is the feeling here of, like, wouldn't it be nice to not have to worry about, you know, what Aquaman is doing right now at the same time? You know, like, it would not have to think about, you know, an entire universe of crossovers and cosmic chaos and, you know, like, portals opening in the sky, or, you know, the issue with the cinematic universe approach to comic book storytelling is that the stakes always have to be, like, galactically high by the end of the movie, because, you know, it's hard to top yourself when you're the 24th entry in a series, right? You know, like, you always just have to be going up and up and up. And here we are with a movie that's, you know, it's got a little bit of...
The stakes are only municipally high.
Exactly. Like, you know, I feel like they do try at the end to make things a little broader and more epic, but even that feels a little forced. This is mostly about a guy plodding around looking at clues, right?
Detective Pokemon, yeah. But Batman. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a little Detective Pokemon. Detective Pikachu. Aww.
Pikachu.
Right.
Wait, there is that.
Even has pointy ears, like Pikachu.
He does. What were you going to say, Spencer?
As someone who's been paying attention to Batman and DC, like, this really isn't connected to anything before, and this is not supposed to be a world in which Ben Affleck's Batman existed. And also, what was the deal with Ben Affleck's Batman? I never like saw any of it other than the movies.
I can try and give a potted history. Yes, you know, obviously, what happened really was you got the Nolan movies in the late 2000s, you know, doing really well. But they're sort of happening in parallel with Marvel beginning its whole Iron Man-led Avengers universe, right? And so by the time Nolan is wrapping up, Marvel is top of the heap with this connected universe thing. And the studio, you know, Warner Brothers, who runs all the DC comics, they're like, oh my God, we have to like get on this trend now. So their efforts, which were led by the director Zack Snyder, you know, we kind of meet Batman late, like... He gets brought, you know, they did a Superman movie first, and then they did Batman versus Superman. And when we're meeting Ben Affleck Batman, like, this is like 20 years into his run Batman. Like, he's a hardened, almost over it, Gotham guy. He's a little tired. I mean, look, I enjoy Ben Affleck, but especially these days, the man gives you tired. The man is like, I just want to go to Duncan. Put my jewel out of frame. It's sort of his, you know, his on-screen affect as Batman. And so that movie did well enough that, yes, the original plan was for this film, The Batman, to be directed by Ben Affleck and starring him. And I think from what I've heard about it, from what Matt Reeves has said, the script was sort of kind of James Bondy. It was sort of like Batman traveling the world or something. And like, I don't, you know, like it was sort of a very sort of high tech. That was sort of Affleck's Batman was very heavy on gadgets and stuff like that. And when Affleck decided he was too busy to make the movie, but he was still going to be in it, I think Reeves was offered the film and he was like, no, thank you. But I would do a Batman movie that was just free of any larger encumbrance, like that was just a Batman movie, just about Batman. We don't need to meet Superman or anybody else. And we don't need to worry about fitting it into a very complicated schedule. And the studio was like, yeah, you know, maybe that's the idea. Maybe we strip that all away.
To me, it's like liberating, because as much as I enjoy the MCU, like, it's exhausting sometimes when you want to see a movie, but you haven't seen all of like the last Marvel series. And you're like, man, I miss these pieces of, you know, who pops up in this cameo and who does what. And you feel like you just need to have absolutely everything seen to comprehend it. So this at least is like much lighter work for the viewer.
But it's also setting up like another multiverse, right?
Or well,
like, that's the worst part of the movie, is the last like 5 minutes of like, guess what? There's going to be many sequels to this.
That's the pitfall, of course, right? You could never plausibly truly say like, this is going to be the only one, right? These things are designed to be followed up on. Like, they always have been. Even the Joker movie, which ends about as definitively as one of these things could, they're talking about making another one of those. You know, you make $1 billion, like, it doesn't, you know, you got to do it.
I want to talk about Robert Pattinson. Spencer, what did you make of his performance of his? I'm asking you because you're the emo kid in residence. Like, what did you make of his?
Wow.
You know, it is a good chance to talk about like the differences in waifish white men who listen to rock and roll, because, you know, I appreciate that he was like Nirvana is his band. So he's not like quite like an emo kid. But, you know, going a little bit deeper back to some truly traumatic times of the early 90s, that's what it felt like it was. Whereas, like, Suicide Squad is very emo. It's, like, very, like, Panic at the Disco aesthetic. So,
right, very topic.
Yeah.
Right.
So this movie is a little bit more in what I would say is my lane as someone who was from the 90s. But I thought Robert completely worked, and you love him in this. You just want to cuddle his, you know, skeletal frame and tell him it's going to be okay. And, you know, and you can tell that when Bruce Wayne steps out of the house for like a rare funeral that he has to attend, probably the city's paparazzi is obsessed with him, because he is like just very like charismatic and striking and sad seeming. And you're just like, what's the deal with that guy? Robert is one ingredient in this movie that is like made up of just like strong ingredients that somehow make 3 hours go by very quickly and absorbingly. He did a great job. This movie's like really gnarly, isn't it?
Yeah, it's grungy for sure. No, it was interesting you mentioned Bruce Wayne and the paparazzi. There was a sort of Kennedy subtext to the Wayne family that I hadn't really picked up on any previous outings. Like when you looked at Thomas Wayne in old footage, he kind of looked like Bobby Kennedy, and all the stories about Martha and her unhappy childhood and the two kind of the Arkham dynasty.
Yeah, 100% the sort of Rosemary Kennedy thing, right?
Yeah, I found that really fascinating. But yes, it was gnarly as hell. I mean, I enjoyed this movie for sure. I don't think I would quite agree with you that it flew by. For me, certainly.
Yeah, okay, I'm maybe exaggerating a little bit there.
It's a long film. Yeah, it's quite long.
But it's very sort of pretty well done technically. Everything is doing what it should do. And yet I left it, and then an hour later, I couldn't sort of think about a single thing that was sticking in my head.
I do agree with you about that.
But yeah, when you talked about the gnarly aspect, like it reminded me of Seven. And I know, David, you said it reminded you of Zodiac 2, another David Fincher movie.
But no, I think Seven is a huge point of comparison in terms of that is also a serial killer movie where the serial killer is always one step ahead of the detective. Yeah. You know what I mean? He is basically leading the detective on a path, not being chased, if that makes sense. So
it makes Batman seem so weak almost that he's sort of not able to keep up intellectually.
Though he can solve any riddle in like... In 5 seconds. Why is he so good at riddles?
Not that hard. I mean, didn't you guys get the riddles?
I would need a minute. I would need a minute. Wait, let me say it out loud again. I would not be able to do
I'd
it.
I'd take a couple
seconds.
Hours to finish my Wordle. So, yeah, I would need some time.
I was sitting there like, justice, guys, it's justice. Anyway, David, what did you think about Robert Pattinson as the Batman?
You know, I'm a major fan of Pat's. Pat's Bats.
Well, he's very handsome.
I think he's very handsome. I think I've had the same journey with him as a star that a lot of people have, where I actually think his performance in the first Twilight is incredible and worth revisiting in terms of like, he seems baffled by the material and is basically like, so this is like a freak, right? And it's like a Nicolas Cage level committed bananas performance. The only problem is that in the subsequent Twilight movies, he's clearly quite bored and sort of has a lot less to do because a lot of those movies sort of background him after a while and he's just kind of standing there being like, and so people sort of, you know, gave up on him as being a truly promising actor, right? He's sort of confined to that series for a while. And then he's had this very interesting phase in the last few years where he's been taking all these interesting parts and working with all these very committed to, you know, artistically sort of whole direct, you know, the Safdies and Robert Eggers, you know, the Good Time, Lighthouse. And then when he popped up in Tenet a couple years ago, the Nolan movie, it was this reminder of like, oh, right, this guy is like super charming and charismatic and handsome, right? Like, oh, this put this guy in some clothes and give him a shave and suddenly like I want him to take me to dinner. Like I sort of forgot about this. And so when he was cast in this, I was like, oh, well, he's okay, sure. He's got like a bit of an edge and he's a little emo, whatever you want to call it, a little grungy, but he'll be a good Bruce Wayne. And then, of course, this movie barely cares about him as Bruce Wayne. He's mostly the Batman. But I said this in my review, playing Batman, it's all about lips and chin, right? Because that's all you've got to work with. You've got a big mask on your face. You got black eyeliner on, right? And he's really good at the scowling and the grimacing and the pouting. Like, he's very locked in my opinion.
To me, he wasn't very expressive, and that was the kind of the point of this take on Batman. I did too, but like, the whole thing is like, oh, I've conquered fear, and it seemed like he was making a very deliberate choice, like not to give the sort of like hammy George Clooney frown or whatever. But I agree that like when you do get that little like kind of like quiver of anything from him, it's quite powerful.
I mean, if I can do a very brief Batman rant,
Please.
I'll try and keep this short.
No. That's
where
not what
else
the podcast
would you do
for.
It but here and now.
If you're talking about the various people who've played this role, like the pathology of them is really different. Like, so Michael Keaton's take was kind of like, this is a fairly bored rich guy who just cannot wait for the bat signal to go up in the sky. Because then he's like, all right, great. Like, you know, there's that thing in Batman Returns where he's just sitting there in his chair, you know, and you're like, what is this guy doing? He's sitting in the dark doing nothing. And then the signal lights up and he's like, okay, good. And then, you know, the Bale take was more, Christian Bale was more like, you know, the light and dark thing where it's like when he's Bruce Wayne, he's giving this sort of performance in and of itself as this kind of like, you know, playboy fool. And when he's Batman, he's also giving this increasingly bananas performance as like the scariest monster you've ever met. He's like, you know, and so like this is a guy who doesn't actually totally even know if he is a person anymore. Like he's always acting. Pattinson's take seems to be like, this guy is sublimating himself into this role, this work, right? Like, as you know, he's a fairly young Batman. He's still kind of figuring it out. So he's good at glowering and, like you say, Spencer, kind of locking it all down. But it doesn't seem, again, like he doesn't really feel like he's figured out what he wants out of all of this, right? Mm-hmm, at the start of the movie. Like, you know, he again, he's good at it. He's good at being Batman and hitting criminals. But I feel like he's still in search of the sort of larger mission.
I found his Batman very entertaining. I found his Bruce Wayne slightly more perplexing. I mean, there was one scene, I think, where Alfred says, I've got you some berries, sir. And he, like, very mournfully chews on a blueberry, and I laughed out loud in the cinema, which made me not very popular. It was just unintentionally hysterical. And there were a couple of moments, because the tone of the movie is so humorless, where things were funny, and you were like, is this intentionally, like, levity, or am I just laughing because everything is so dour?
I think mostly the latter. The only person in this movie who gets to have any fun really is Colin Farrell, who is like,
hell yeah,
trying.
I don't believe it's Colin Farrell.
The most fun.
Oh, I do not believe it's Colin Farrell in that. No, I don't believe it's Colin Farrell, and I don't believe it's Paul Dano. I think they got two like jobbing actors to just wear the makeup, and then they franchise like the movie stars.
No. I mean, like the thing with Colin Farrell in this, I'm sure we'll talk about it more, but like, right when you first see the look where he's buried under all that makeup, I was like, yeah, why even cast an actor that's well known, because like you can bear, but then you see the performance and he's just clearly like, oh great, I can give a 5,000% performance in this because like I'm so constrained that it will come off over the top even if I'm like way over the top.
It's a beautiful corrective to what Jared Leto did in House of Gucci. If Colin Farrell's like 5,000% over the top, like Jared Leto put on a fat suit similarly and was like 1,000,000% over the top. And you can see their choices do matter when you're underneath all that makeup. Cause like here, you love the Penguin. He's just kind of funny. He's
fun.
He's like, get the hell away from me. Like, leave me alone.
That.
That's what I found. Like, he felt like an ad for Goodfellas Pizza. Like, I'm sorry. All right, let's talk about Detective Batman. I did not know until we were prepping for this that DC stands for Detective Comics.
Sure does.
What did you both think of the sort of orientation of Batman as like someone, a sleuth, a noirish, you know, private eye on the case in this very dark, very bad city?
It didn't. I guess I'm not that familiar with Batman's detective origins.
He's the world's greatest detective, Spencer.
Okay, you can give the spiel. But as someone who only knows Batman from, you know, glancingly in popular culture over the years, it sort of was random when, you know, and the movie acknowledges this, that like with the other cops on the crime scene being like, why is this guy here? why? Like, this is not his specialty. It's not his deal. And, you know, what part of what is very effective about the movie is that it's a highly competent detective movie, is like 1/3 of what it's doing. And everything about that, it just kind of works. And it works in a way that's very, you know, familiar from these other movies that we've mentioned, like Seven and Zodiac. And then I imagine even further back in film noir history, like it's really like it's playing with those beats very competently. I don't quite get like why that's Batman's skill set here. And it doesn't ever go out of his way to explain that. Like, for example, the riddles thing, like why is he so good at riddles? But I just let that go. But I guess I do need to hear your spiel about why he is a good detective, because it's not in the canon that dummies like me have absorbed over the years.
Yeah, I guess it's never been too crucial to his cinematic canon. It's certainly part of all of them. He's got his Batcave. He's got his sort of computers. It's both the noir thing, right? Like especially when the character was at his original height in the 40s, the era of the dark noir. And if Superman is the big flying hero who fights people in the daytime, Batman is this sort of creepy crawly guy who's lurking around at night. And obviously he debuted in a series called Detective Comics, and so, you know, he's fighting criminals rather than like supervillains. Like you know what I mean? Like Batman eventually gets supervillains in his rogue, but like originally he was really a guy who was fighting like mobsters and stuff. Like that was sort of his conception.
Like Dick Tracy.
Yeah, sure. Right. Or the Shadow, you know, those sort of pulpy villain heroes of the 30s and stuff.
On that note, like, is the disgusting, crime-ridden, drug-addled city of 80s and 70s cinema, like, is that back, or is it just, like...
Did it ever go away?
Well, I felt like it sort of did. I don't know. At least I grew up being very frightened of the city because of movies like the 90s Batman. You know, now it's... I don't know. What portrayals of cities have we had recently that are full of sweet greens and condos? You know, because that's the that's sort of the reality it's moved towards.
I mean, that's I guess that is the vibe of the Marvel movies. Those are set in the real world. Those are set in recognizable. And they, you know, Marvel has this kind of very monochromatic gray slate kind of, you know, a lot of those fights just take place in parking lots and stuff. Just because, again, that's kind of an easy place to dump everyone and do your special effects around them, right? You know, like the less elements around them, the better. This is a little more reminiscent of a grimy 70s movie, sure, which is a fun throwback, I guess. I like this movie, but I feel like I am also just like here to defend it. And like, it's a little pummeling, and I don't mind that. Uh-huh. I don't mind picking a bit, right? And he's picked his bit. Like, this is going to be serious. This is going to be mystery-focused. My Gotham is going to be dark and moody. And that's great. And I like Matt Reeves. He made the Planet of the Apes sequels, Dawn and War. And those were similarly movies where I'm like, you've picked your bit. This has a lot of storytelling integrity, but it's a little one note. Like, whoa. I'm walking out being like, grim. I get it. Like that one was grim.
And there are all these characters who, you know, get maybe like 2 minutes total of screen time. And then there are all these kind of interesting illusions, like, you know, what is better for Bruce Wayne to do? You know, should he prowl the city at night as in a costume, or should he just donate money to help, you know, clean up the city
control of his dad's
fund the orphanage and get the drop heads out? And, you know, and then at the end, I actually did find very fascinating and very bleak the sort of Riddler's ultimate evil plot, which was to get his group of similarly disenfranchised and violent young men to stand at the top of the Madison Square Garden or Gotham Square Garden or whatever it was and rain down violence from above.
I
can't say I liked it, but it felt sort of topical in a sort of really uncomfortable way as we, you know, think about current news and, you know, epidemics of mass shootings in America and things like that. It just felt overwhelming, I think. So nothing really was allowed to settle or get under my skin. It just all was kind of barraging, and then it was over.
This movie is 3 hours long. It has two action sequences total, basically. It has a car chase in the middle, and it has the ending sequence that you're talking about. I have this feeling that, I have no idea if this is true, but like that Warner Brothers was like, Matt, we're giving you ample budget and artistic, you know, you can do what you want, but come on, like, you gotta give us a climax. He's gotta be Batman, he's gotta save some people or something. Like, it can't just be him grumbling at Jeffrey Wright all the time while they look at facts, you know, readouts or whatever. So I understand the concept that Batman needs to maybe realize, like, I'm here for a city and I'm here to, you know, for a community more than I'm just here to like punch criminals in the face and feel better about myself.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
it's kind of like, I think this movie is very, very good at what it does, but it sort of feels like sad that this energy has all been expended on, you know, a Batman movie. Like, like Matt Reeves is obviously an incredible director, I think. And this is probably not what he dreamt of doing with his talents.
He might have.
But also, this is the curse of the franchise, right? Like, you make a tentpole Batman movie, you know that people are going to go see it, which is not a guarantee for, you know, an original character. I wanted to ask you guys, is there any way, like, we've seen sort of various iterations of Batman, starting with Adam West's extremely hokey, that's, talk about bright Batman, that is a very bright series. And then, you know, the Keatons, and then the Clooney era, the Val Kilmers and Christian Bale, which seemed to get a lot more serious and sort of was a lot more interesting for it. Is there a new way to do Batman that doesn't rely so heavily on, I don't know, Saw style torture masks and Nirvana, and like, is there an intellectual Batman? Is there any, is like a way to shake this franchise
more
up?
Fun.
Not even more fun, maybe. But like, how, if you were pitching a Batman franchise, like, how would you make it distinct? I think, because everything to me just feels like Dark Batman feels so overplayed at this point. Yeah. But I also don't know what else you do with a man in a codpiece.
That is the other thing I would say about this movie, is like, it is a good version of this, but I don't feel like it really pushed this character anywhere all that new for me.
Yeah.
I guess if I was to pitch a new one, I would say, what if it was like a Lego Batman?
I mean, look, Lego Batman, which is a great film, if you guys have not seen it.
Is it? Okay.
Oh, I have.
I'm sure Sophie has, because I know your daughter loves Batman.
She does.
It is one of the finest, I would say, takes on Batman's personality as like a kind of lonely weirdo without being someone who just like puts black eye makeup on and listens to something in the way. Like, there's that early sequence in Lego Batman where he like gets home to his mansion after doing heroism, and he gets a little Lego lobster and he puts it on a Lego plate and he puts it into his Lego microwave, and then he just watch it revolve, and then he eats his Lego lobster and watches Jerry Maguire in his Lego cinema, and you're just like, yeah, I guess this is this guy's life. He doesn't have anything else going on, and it's both like sweet and sad, and like it's why that movie is so. But obviously, that movie gets to have fun because it's Lego, and what you're talking about, Sophie, is like, it's very difficult to chart some new path with a character who dresses up as a bat. Like, you can go full goofy like they did back in the day, or you can do this where you're like, let's try and strip it down and make it as sort of plausible as possible. But yeah, you know, at the end of the day, he's dressed like a bat. It's weird. Like, why are you dressed like a bat? Why is everyone not just like, you're like a bat? Why do you look like that? What's going on with you? Well, like, you know.
But this somehow isn't a problem that the Marvel franchise has. Like, they managed to be pretty funny and zany.
Absolutely. That is a code they crack. And that's what pisses people off about those movies. And I get it, like, that those movies have to have that slightly winky tone to sell it. And they have that kind of jokey dialogue that's become, you know, corny and overused. But that's how you pull that off, right? You have to have that smooth tone throughout.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the movie's like sort of like has to pull its punch. Like, it's not fully Saw. It's not fully Seven. Where can't go to this full gore place because it is, you know, a comic book movie. But Paul Dano seems like he is on the verge of showing you something absolutely disgusting. I mean, it shows you some very disturbing things, but like, he is actually like truly frightening, I thought.
Yeah, well, that's what's interesting about the power of the mask that they allude to in the movie a few times. Like, once he's unmasked, he's just not as terrifying. And you do feel that, like, Batman, he even says this, that there's something about being hidden that makes him more fully able to be himself.
Well, but this is the thing with the Dano Riddler performance, which I have no beef with. I think he's doing exactly what the movie wants. And like you say, Spencer, you know, he's got moments where you're like, oh, this is genuinely unsettling. But it is like, what you see is what you get, right? Like, in the first scene where he's revealed, I'm like, okay, I get it. And then the movie's like, that's it. You know, that's his.
Right.
And I'm
like, great. There's no build up from there.
Same with the Penguin, where it's like, what's this guy's deal? It's like, yeah, he's like, right, he's off a pizza box. He's a big, loud mobster. And I'm like, great. Anything else? No. Okay, cool. And then same with Catwoman. What's her deal? She's like a cat burglar lady. She drinks milk. Like, apart from that, she's just a cat burglar lady. And I'm like, great.
John Turturro, though.
You nailed it.
Obviously a bad man from the beginning, though. Like, there's no twists with any of these characters. There's nothing that surprises you.
Everyone understands the assignment, to use internet parlance of today, and I don't think anyone gives a bad performance. I think Andy Serkis was fine, but I kind of felt bad for him in that I was like, wow, there's no space for a new Alfred, is there? Like, there's classic reedy English butler Alfred, and then there's what Michael Caine did, where he gruffs him up a little bit and has the Cockney accent and hints at the military background. And Serkis is clearly like, yeah, I don't know what I'm supposed to do here. I guess I'll kind of be Cockney too. I'll be kind of like, all right, mate, you know, like, but it's sort of like, all right, Alfred, get out of here. We get your deal, you know. But like, everyone else, I think, gives an excellent performance and is styled well and is compelling when they're on screen. But it's kind of like what you guys said, was like, there's nothing I was walking out of that movie being like, I can't stop thinking about X as the, you know, Paul Dano. I can't stop thinking about what was going on in that movie. I more was just sort of like, that was an 8 out of 10 experience. I was like a great pizza pie. I ate it. I had a good time.
Is there anything that the upcoming HBO Penguin series, God, which just makes me tired thinking about it, just that much like, ayo, ayo.
I mean, my guess, I'm intrigued by that in terms of like, if you're going to do a Batman sequel, right? The problem with Batman movies, and Matt Reeves has talked about this, is that you always have your first Batman movie that is about a billionaire whose parents were killed and he becomes the Batman, right? Like, you've
which
got
I did
Batman
appreciate
story,
them
which,
leaving out this
mercifully
time.
They leave
respect
out,
for the audience
by and large.
They know that we know.
And then by the second movie, Batman's whole deal has been completely settled. He is Batman. And so the sequels are always just villain showcases, right? Like, they're just like, who we got now? And then they take over the movie. And Reeves was like, I wanted to do a movie about, you know, Batman is still figuring things out, but we don't have to watch pearls fall on the floor for the time. Like, right? Like, we don't need to deal with all that over and over again. And, you know, the emotional through line of this movie is Batman. So if you're going to do a TV series, that's great, because now there's some space for villains to pop up and you can explore some more Gotham marginalia and you can give me a little sense of the city of crime. And then once we go back to the Batman 2, we can have a rich world for him to be playing around in that we've gotten some contact. I don't mind it. I'm not like pumping my fists for a Penguin show, but I could imagine how it would be interesting.
Did you, and you watched that Gotham show that ran for a few years?
I watched it for a bit. I forgot about that one. Yeah, right.
Right? Like, they've done a Penguin show.
Yeah, that was like, right. That was Gotham pre-Batman. Like, Batman is a kid in that movie, in that show. So it's about young Commissioner Gordon and, yeah, the Penguin's in that. The Riddler's in that as well. Catwoman's in that. They're all in it. Look, it's Batman. What can I tell you? Right? I mean, it's the end of the day.
He's a man.
That's the podcast.
And a bat.
Well, like, this is the whole thing with Batman. I'm like, oh, I can't wait to see the fourth take on the Riddler. You know, like, at a certain point, what are we doing?
But this, I mean,
as much as I enjoyed this film,
there is potential, I mean, though. Like, yeah. I think we've seen one thing that we've really seen is like three incredibly different, each equally effective. Well, I'm going to leave out Jared Leto, so I'll say three, not four, interpretations of the Joker. Like, I think Jack Nicholson's haunts me to this day. Heath Ledger's obviously was just changed our understanding of what comic book villainy could be. Right.
That's a really, really incredible thing to this day to watch him.
And then, you know, Joaquin Phoenix and his sort of weird King of Comedy Joker origin story. So, like, I'm not tired by the idea of more villains. I find Penguin the least interesting of all of them. And I cannot imagine what you're going to do in a 10-hour series about a man whose defining characteristic seems to be accent.
Well, what is Penguin's power? Isn't it, doesn't have something to do with an umbrella? No. And then he also like has children in the wells in the Burton movie or something.
That's all Tim Burton's take, right? Okay. In the comics, he's just a gangster, who maybe has some fun umbrellas, you know, like that's, you know, he does like to have a good bulletproof umbrella or whatever. But Tim Burton was the one who was like, this guy should be half a penguin, which I think everyone was like,
no, wasn't he was, how he, would was that raised, work? He was raised by penguins at the Gotham Zoo. He was an orphan.
It's the classic Batman thing, you know, she fell into a bunch of cats, he fell into a bunch of penguins, that's why he's a penguin. Which again, no beef, and like I think Matt Reeves has talked about wanting to bring back Mr. Freeze, another Batman character who obviously usually trends more cartoony. I can't wait to see, you know, what sort of bespoke, gritty Mr. Freeze he's going to cook up. I mean, look, obviously the heyday of the Joel Schumacher silly Batman is well behind us, and no one's ever going to quite dare get that campy again. But Arnold Schwarzenegger just popping up and saying the Iceman cometh as he like sends ice skating gangsters at Batman, like it's the apex of something, right? Like that we do have to preserve it for future generations.
It's making me nostalgic now because I really did enjoy those movies as a kid.
One of my favorite scenes is when Peter Skarsgård is talking to Zoe Kravitz, and you see it through her lens, and he is obviously like high on these drops, and it's just this kind of like trippy, hallucinogenic, kind of like nice. He like seems like he's having a good time, and it's another vision like moment where I'm like, this is a cool aesthetic thing that Matt Reeves has come up with here that I wish was getting used for like an original techno thriller rather than thrown into this like gigantic Batman gumbo.
That's a great way of describing the movie, gigantic Batman gumbo.
And it's appropriately seedy. It's a good kind of seedy. Not that, especially that feels realistically seedy.
It was nice to see Peter Sarsgaard after obviously Maggie was in a Batman movie, so he probably wanted one of his own.
Spoiler alert for The Dark Knight and this movie, but it is funny that both Peter Sarsgaard and Maggie Gyllenhaal have been blown up during Batman entries.
It's true.
Like, I wonder if Peter Sarsgaard, like, you know, just at the kitchen table with Maggie being like, yeah, I blow up on page 45. What do you think? You made it to, like, page 80, but anyway.
David, I have a question for you about Christopher Nolan's Batman trilogy, which is, like, in Batman Begins, Gotham is obviously Chicago, and then suddenly in The Dark Knight, it's New York, and then in The Dark Knight Rises, it's extremely New York. So how does that happen?
I actually really like that about the Nolan movies, right? The first movie is very Chicago-y and has a sort of a neighborhood called the Narrows that is very comic booky, that is like dank and sort of exactly like, you know, like very evocative of the comic books. And it's supposed to reflect Gotham as a pit of crime that needs to be either, you know, purged or healed or whatever, right? And then by Dark Knight, with Batman on the scene and things changing, it's become this more Michael Mann, like this kind of burnished, like a lot of skyscrapers. Like, I like how he evolves Gotham every time to reflect how Batman is gentrifying things and changing things. And like, that doesn't mean the criminality goes away, but it's different. Like in The Dark Knight, the criminals, the mobsters all have a bank, and like they have meetings in their suits and all that, you know what I mean? Like they're a little more corporatized. And then by Dark Knight Rises, it's become this kind of Occupy Wall Street thing, right? And so he's like, yeah, we'll just set it downtown in Manhattan, essentially.
It's a Staten Island ferry.
Right. It is implausible, but that's what I like about Nolan, is he's just like, I'm sure if he said shared universe to that guy, he would have been like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, I don't care about that. So he's just like, I'm just going to do what I want. Like, and the constants will be the constants, and the others won't, you know, I don't need to worry about continuity. And now all of that is verboten. Now, of course, these things have to exist to tease audiences about future entries, you know, and they have to have internal consistency because, you know, what if what if Wonder Woman,
you need to sell the map on the back of the Happy Meal
with the Flash, right? You know, so you know, and like, that's Spencer, I'm glad you mentioned Happy Meals. The funniest thing about this movie is it is so damn realistic. They're trying to make toys out of like the Colin Farrell penguin, and it's like, here's middle-aged guy in suspenders, like Happy Christmas. Like, what kid is going to enjoy any of this?
Do they have the gold
tooth? Gimp suit Riddler. I hope you like it.
God, yeah,
that's nightmare.
God, you know, when
the
Jim
children
Carrey,
are not going to be okay.
When Jim Carrey took that role in 95 or whatever Batman Forever came out, like, he was like, green spandex, question marks all over it. I want a bowler hat. I want a gold staff. Like, I am the Riddler. I am not just some guy. Anyway, it's just funny to think about how the 90s Batman movies were so driven by toy sales. Like, right. Like, that was such a crucial economic element for these things. And now it's like, not only do we not care about that, we kind of actively want to avoid it. We don't want to seem like we're trying to make action figures over here.
What can we do with this movie to extrapolate what superhero movies are, what they might be in the future? Like, because this to me just seemed like a very well done, very pretty generic, predictable iteration of a big superhero Batman movie. Like, as we've said, there weren't too many surprises. There was nothing really below the belt or out of the ordinary. Like, is this sort of where we're going with this field now?
I, as someone who doesn't, like, I'm not like the superhero movie guy, but have dropped into a few of them over the past few years. And I will say this movie and the last Spider-Man movie, which we talked about on the cast, were amazing times in the theater for me. Like, I really enjoyed both of them. And it felt like filmmakers really playing in a very well-defined sandbox, but doing really creative and high-quality stuff within them. And again, it just, like, brings me, like, that's cool, but it also brings me to this sort of, like, sad feeling, like, this is the only opportunity that filmmakers have to, you know, use the budget and the resources and the attention to do something ambitious. And Matt Reeves has talked about this, that, like, he asked in some interview, like, if in another era, what could I have gotten all these actors to be drawn in this movie? Maybe not, but it's the only game in town. He's talking about superhero movies and talking about how, you know, he wants to do ambitious kind of auteur work, and this is the way that he can do it. So I guess, like, that's cool that we got this good of a Batman movie, but maybe someday we can have just the good Matt Reeves blockbuster of his dreams.
Right. So your answer is less superhero movies, which I agree with. Yes.
Yeah, less superhero movies, but, like, also, like, let's do this without the Batman, and, like, not force him to, like, have the third act apocalypse.
What's David Fincher doing these days, David?
Well, David Fincher is a perfect example of what we are talking about, in that he is a very successful filmmaker who's been nominated for Oscars and has made many hits. And after Gone Girl, another hit, right, that, like, did really well and had movie stars in it and so on, Hollywood was basically like, your movies are too expensive, and I do not seem to be about superheroes at all. Like, I'm not noticing any superheroes. And he kept getting attached to projects.
Gone Girl, that's like a superhero name, though. The Gone Girl.
And so, no, you're absolutely right, of course. No, he became this perfect example of, like, the celebrated auteur who absolutely needs, like, a lot of money and time to play around with, right? Like, David Fincher is probably not going to go off and make a movie for $15 million. Like, he needs a big, expansive budget because he's meticulous and he's perfectionist or what, you know, like, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And so studios just sort of stopped bothering with him. The same thing happened to Martin Scorsese, where obviously anyone wants to be in the Martin Scorsese business, but Paramount, his classic studio, just, like, were like, well, we can't give you $200 million to make The Irishman, like, even though you have, like, De Niro, Pacino, like, even though it's this glorious thing, because it's a lot of money for a movie that's not going to play overseas and that isn't going to have a sequel or anything like that. And so where are they all now? They're at the streamers, like the streamers who want the prestige, who will pony up the money. So David Fincher made Mank for Netflix, and now he's making a movie called The Killer for Netflix. Martin Scorsese made The Irishman at Netflix. He's making a movie for Apple right now. You know, like, that is unfortunately, or fortunately, or whatever we want to say, like, those are the companies right now that are willing to take financial risks on movies that are not necessarily going to be tent poles, right?
That doesn't feel fully economically sustainable to me. Like, I see the streamers paying this amount of money right now, but you saw Netflix have a sort of share tumble crisis a few months ago. Like, it doesn't seem like they will be happy to do this forever, which does make you wonder what happens to this kind of movie.
Well, honestly, I think Netflix, et cetera, will always be happy to pony up money for a couple projects that are that size from very major filmmakers like Fincher or whoever. It's more even the Matt Reeves types who are obviously good at their jobs and are quite celebrated, but maybe aren't the kind of juggernaut names that you're just sort of like, yeah, what do you want to do? Name your price, right? You know. That's who I would more worry about in the grand sort of financial scheme of things. And yeah, I mean, I don't know if Matt Reeves has spent day and night dreaming about making a Batman movie. He probably likes Batman. He probably wanted to make a Batman movie. But yeah, he might have other projects that he'd love to do. And he's either going to, maybe he can use this Batman clout to get it done. Or maybe he's going to have to make it for a lot less money, right, for a smaller, that maybe that's the way he sneaks it through. I don't know. Only sort of Christopher Nolan, Quentin Tarantino, the absolute big boys, are the types who could just sort of go to a studio and be like, I'm in charge. You're putting this movie in theaters. You're giving me as much money as I want, and it's going to be about whatever I want. There's just not a lot of filmmakers left like that. Yeah. And maybe the death of massive, big swinging dick ego boy filmmakers, maybe we can handle that, and maybe it's fine that Hollywood is evolving. I'm not saying woe is David Fincher, he's doing fine, but how many Batman movies have there been? And I like Batman.
Everyone does.
I like it. I think he's very compelling.
Well, this is the conundrum, right? Because it's kind of depressing that these Batman, Superman, Spider-Man movies are the only ones that truly rake in the cash, but at the same time, I want to see them, and we talk about them, and they're excited. Fun. So there is some, we've talked about this before on the pod, there is something about the reliability of the familiar storytelling structure, the familiar hero, the familiar, it feels safe in a way sometimes when you're exhausted and tired and stressed about the world. It feels safe in a way that a fully novel story maybe feels like too much work. Maybe that's just me being exhausted, but it's a little sad, but that's also the paradox, I think. I don't want to end this on this bummer note, because God knows the Batman is bummer enough. So I would love to end this with a game. Who of all the iterations of Batman, who is your favorite and why? And we can't all pick Christian Bale. We can't all pick Christian Bale. And I love Christian Bale, as you mentioned, David, just because of his, where is he?
Where is he? Tell me where you're hiding that thing.
I do this with my child now. She is she loves Batman. She's never seen a Batman movie. Obviously, we tried to make her watch Lego Batman, and she didn't care. But she has a Batman figurine. She loves him. There was a kid dressed as Batman in the park the other day, and she lost her mother-loving mind and was like, Papa! Papa! And she stalked this poor kid all around the playground. She followed him on the merry-go-round, and she just kept grabbing me and saying, bah, bah, bah. And that was exciting. But we also, we ask her, what do lions say? Rah! What do monkeys say? Woo-hoo-hoo! What does Batman say?
Where's he? Do I look like a cop? That's my favorite Batman.
Who Bale sent Batman. You?
I mean, Bale is so good when he is yelling. It's just hilarious when he then has to have a regular conversation. Yeah.
Spencer, who's the best Batman?
I would say that the one that meant the most to me was the 90s animated Batman. 90s animation, there were so many kind of interchangeable feeling shows about superheroes and also the duck versions of them, but they were all good. And I definitely preferred that Batman to the Tim Burton and Schumacher movies, which I found disgusting and horrible as a kid. And I don't like to revisit them. They're revolting works that just feel completely like everything that cinema has reacted against for the better. So I'm going to leave this podcast by nuking those beloved films.
Wow, all
Wait,
of them.
Tell me more. Everything that's... How has cinema reacted against... I understand the Schumacher, yes, but what about the Burtons repels
you? That they're so covered in gunk and everyone is quivering and nothing is realistic at all. And everyone's like sort of like
oh sure, yeah. No, I get that, right.
You know, like it's truly sicko stuff, and it's amazing that he got to make those movies and inflict them upon a generation and give us all our traumas. But yeah, I mean, I have not enjoyed rewatching them over the years. I'm just like, this is so gross to me, but that's just, you know, my own thing. I need to probably see a therapist about.
So, Spencer, you're picking Kevin Conroy's animated Batman, which is a sure. fine choice
yes.
from like Mask yeah. of the Phantasm and the TV show and all that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm very fond of the Bale performance. I think it's good. I recently found some like DVD extra I had never seen where Nolan is talking about like auditioning Batman for Batman Begins. And they show you the screen. Cillian Murphy, who's in that movie, obviously is the villain, the Scarecrow, was sort of the runner-up.
Oh, so good.
And they show you the screen tests that Bale and Murphy had. And Murphy's screen test is like not bad, and he's wearing like the Val Kilmer suit or whatever. But then you see the Bale one, you're like, oh, he's literally, there was nothing to change. He had the performance like all set at the audition prod. Like he just knew exactly how this character should function. So like, I think that's obviously sort of a definitive Batman, and that's fine. But I will absolutely stick up for the Keaton Batman. I really like the sort of mix of squirrely and psychotic that he has, like in those Burton movies. He's great. He's still such unusual casting. Like, obviously, people rioted at the time, and then they were satisfied or whatever. But like, he is so good at playing mania in weird ways, like, and he's almost underrated now, obviously, on that front. But I like that performance a lot.
Yeah, no, I was gonna say Keaton's kind of slightly deranged element. I think it comes out in one moment in Batman when he's like, "You want to get nuts?"
yeah,
and you're like, "Whoa, where did that come from?"
So scary.
Yeah, there's, you know, Clooney, God bless him, is the only truly pitiful Batman, and I love George Clooney as an actor.
It's true.
And I love what he did with his career, but he looks so lost in that movie. There's no take, obviously. That movie doesn't really have anything for Batman to do. And his most sort of pathetic moment is when he shows up and Mr. Freeze is like, "I'm Mr. Freeze," and he's doing it, and he's like, "Hi, Freeze, I'm Batman." It's like, what, this is how you behave? You just like introduce yourself?
They're at an ideas festival.
That's the vibe of those Schumacher Batman movies that I do kind of like, where it's like, we're throwing a society ball to open the new wing of the museum. Everyone's invited. The mayor, Batman, like, and Batman's just like, "Hi, how's everyone doing?" Just walking around in a rubber suit. Oh, boy.
He should be doing detective work, asking the questions, chewing the gum.
Right, he should be gum chewing.
Solving the riddles.
Leather, whatever.
We should see more riddles in the next movie. Batman should get into Wordle.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Or spelling bee.
Sudoku.
Yeah, right. Sudoku. Puzzle solving Batman.
Yeah, that should be the Riddler's new thing in the second one. He's only sending Sudokus.
That does it for this show. The Review is produced by Kevin Townsend with help from AC Valdez. The executive producer of Atlantic Podcasts is Claudine Abade, and our art is by Charlie Lemignon. I'm Sophie Gilbert. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Thank you, Spencer.
Thank you.
We'll be back next week. Kevin, do we want to try a different game, or is that one good?
I think that one's good. we can call it on that.
On the games.
I like the idea of the Wordler, finishing things out with the Wordler. That dastardly Wordler's up to it again.
He's not even letting me use my vowels again. I can't do a Wordle joke. Forget it.
I did another double letter. Killed my streak.